a week after hackers brought the city of Atlanta to its knees in a massive cyber attack, residents are still reporting problems accessing city government websites. As hackers crippled the city's servers with malicious software, millions of Atlanta residents were left scrambling to pay their traffic tickets or water bills online. The city could not process court cases or warrants, and police officers had to write reports by hand.
A former Russian intelligence officer who worked with President Donald Trump's former campaign officials Paul Manafort and Rick Gates communicated with Gates during the 2016 campaign. That bombshell emerged in court records filed late Tuesday by special counsel Robert Mueller's office. The records concern the case of Alex van der Zwaan, a Dutch lawyer about to become the first person to be sentenced in Mueller's Russia investigation. Van der Zwaan has pled guilty to lying about his communications with Gates and the mysterious Person A.
It was already dabbling in solar power. Now, though, the sector in Saudi Arabia is really heating up. Japan's SoftBank Group is investing in a plan to create the world's biggest solar project. The aim is to have the capacity to produce up to 200 gigawatts by 2030. That's half the world's current solar capacity and half what its nuclear power capacity was in 2016.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Thursday. It's March 29th, and it's 5:10 in the morning. We're glad you're here with us for another business day and another edition of The Opening Bell getting underway. Good broadcast for you today. A little bit later, we're going to be talking about the 50th anniversary of the Fair Housing Act. Lucy Baird will be here from Baird and Warner. She's the company historian there, and we will look back in time at the 50th anniversary of the Fair Housing Act. Don Lloyd is here. He's our thought leader today. It's Thought Leader Thursday here on The Opening Bell. We'll have a conversation with Don coming up momentarily, but first, on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, Dow futures are pointing toward opening gains later this morning on Wall Street. Dow futures are up 85 points right now. NASDAQ futures are up about 55. And S&P futures are up about 12 this morning. Looking around the world, markets are generally higher in Europe, with the FTSE up almost a third, the DAX up more than a percent, and the CAC up about a third as well. And in Asia this morning, markets are mixed, with the Nikkei up 127 points, good for about a half a percent. Shanghai's up about a percent this morning as well. Markets elsewhere mixed to negative in Asia. And oil is trading at $64.52 a barrel, which is up about 15 cents this morning. A couple of stories that we're watching for you. Chicago-based Boeing says it detected a limited intrusion of malware that affected a small number of systems and said certain media reports of disruptions were overstated and inaccurate. That, according to a company vice president yesterday, Linda Mills, the vice president of Boeing Commercial Airplanes Communications, said that the remediations were applied and that the intrusion would not impact production or deliveries. It was reported by the Seattle Times yesterday that that was not the case, that perhaps the malware was more widespread and might actually impact production. A new study has found that direct-to-consumer genetic tests like those marketed by 23andMe, Ancestry.com, FamilyTree DNA, and MyHeritage produce bogus results. As a matter of fact, 40% of the DNA results from those consumer genetic tests might be bogus. That reported by MIT Science Technology Review yesterday. Thought Leader Thursday here on The Opening Bell, and Don Lloyd is here today. He's the SVP of Capital Markets, Foreign Exchange, and Derivatives at Associated Bank. And Don, we're happy to have you here this morning. We're going to chat a little bit about trade and some other things. But first, good morning. Welcome to The Opening Bell.
Steve, good morning. How have you been?
Doing very well. Very anxious to talk to you today because you're sort of our global guy and thought leader conversations. And boy, we've had a lot of global news since you've been here last.
The 24-hour news cycle, I'm sure, has been full, from tariffs and trades to Stormy Daniels and stocks. So there's a full 24-hour news panel that's out there.
It's the first two that we're concerned about this morning, tariffs and trade.
Yep.
What should we be concerned about as we sit here today?
Well, you know me. I'm all about free trade. I don't think tariffs, I don't think trade wars are good for anyone. That being said, I also don't believe that administrations go off half-cocked. I think there is a bigger master plan behind all of this. When you're sitting there throwing the trade and tariff card onto the table and you're sort of going nose to nose with China, I do believe that there are back channel discussions being being had on as far as let's come to some agreement on this. And I think the rattling of the cage, the tariffs, the trade war rhetoric, and maybe even some of the tariffs that are coming out on some of the items that are there, you know, are just to get people's attention and get them at the table. You know, I think the real negotiations are behind the doors right now. And just the whole scenario of what it means for the global markets, for Europe, how is Europe going to benefit from that? And in the long run, is that a good thing for the U.S.? So, you know, the tariffs on the surface look bad. I'm not a big believer in them. But I think there's a bigger game behind everything that has yet to be revealed.
Yeah, you know, the tariffs, and different from the other trade stories that we've been seeing, the tariffs, he's now exempted. The Trump administration's now exempted 5 of the 6.
Yep.
So that's sort of negated that whole situation.
Right.
But the trade war, that's... I'm confused about that. I'm not sure what the backroom conversation is unless they're just trying to get better deals, like the South Korea deal that we heard from today.
Right.
More cars going to South Korea at a better price.
Right. The administration's been very consistent in saying that these trade agreements are not favorable to the U.S. Most of them aren't. Vast majority are not favorable to the U.S. And I think he wants to address that. So I think he throws that card. I think he rattles it a little bit, and it's the behind-the-scenes discussions that are occurring. So more cars, you know, the whole agreement with it. You're going to see lots of these little things popping up and coming to the surface because he's forcing people to the table. You have to. I mean, if you're going to sit there and start throwing tariffs around and start charging, it's going to bring people to the table because the U.S. economy is just too big. You know, we're a global leader out there, and as the U.S. emerges and as we have emerged, the rest of the world goes with it. And if we start rattling the cage a little bit, it's going to bring people to the table to discuss. So I think this was the opening salvo. There's lots of discussions going on behind it. It's going to be really interesting to see what's going to come out of it.
How is this affecting the focus of your world, and that's the currency markets?
Yeah, in the currency markets, there hasn't been a lot of movement. Everybody's sort of on the sideline to see what's going to happen. You have to remember the currency market, the foreign exchange markets don't lead markets. They are a final output, a result of capital flows that move around. So take a look at global stock markets. Take a look at global bond markets. What's going on there? Where is that hot money moving? And that's going to drive through the FX markets. And then those exchange rates will end up wherever they end up. So the foreign currency markets don't lead anything. They're a final output. So when you take a look at, just take a look at the domestic stock market, what's happening? Down 400, up 600 on the Dow. Very, very big swings, very, very nervous. You know, 2% moves are big. And there's a lot of jittering going on there. But what's really changed when you take a step back and said, what is really corrected? What is really advanced? Not a lot. We've had maybe a 10% correction in the Dow, and that seems to have come back a little bit. Same with the overseas markets. You know, there hasn't been a lot of movement in that yet. So to me, I see a lot of jittering, a lot of nervousness. It's like horses in a chute getting ready to run. And if they're going to run forward or backward, we don't know which way they're going to run yet. But they are just in the chute, ready to bolt. And it is now the time to do it? You're seeing all that all over the place.
Yeah, and the dollar is still a star of the show, but there's been talk that maybe there should be looking elsewhere to the euro or something like that. Seems kind of scary to be thinking the dollar might not be at the top there anymore.
Yeah, you know, the market likes to sit there and you know, that they have to put out their daily supply of information, current information. And if the markets are sideways and just sort of bouncing sideways like they are in this nervous state, they have to still come out with information. And it's okay to sit there and say, the markets are sort of in chains right now. They're sort of moving sideways right now until they get some direction of what's going on. Because on one hand, you've got tariffs. On the other hand, you've got the U.S. economy and the world global economy pushing up. You know, on the other hand, you've got this thing called Brexit that sits out there. And that's the 800-pound gorilla that sort of sits in the background. So you've got all of these pieces that are out there, and they haven't really come together yet on what's going to propel this amoeba into the next direction, the next market move that you're going to see. Personally, I'm not a big dollar bull at this stage, simply because tariffs are not good. I want to see what comes out of these discussions. But at the bottom line, tariffs are not good for the United States. They're not good for the dollar. Again, we'll see what kind of trade agreements come out, but that could be a six-month process.
So when you hear stories where we hear things like reserve managers at central banks are looking to add more euros, what's the end real-time, real-world result of that?
I don't put a lot of value in a lot of that. I mean, what is a reserve currency in the first place? You know, whether you're a country, a nation, an individual, what do you feel comfortable holding? What is a good store of value? What has liquidity that is easily convertible? What currencies represent those nations that have the infrastructure to handle flows, the consistency and the stability within that infrastructure to sit there and handle the capital markets and to handle the money? The United States is a big one in there. The euro sort of fell off the radar screen simply because when European rates, interest rates, went so low, the negative return on that, there was no real sense to hold on to the euro as a reserve currency. It just didn't make sense. I mean, if you're sitting there holding some asset in euro, this reserve currency in euro, and it's losing value when compared after inflation, the real rate of return on that, no sense. Get rid of it. Okay, so now you're sort of seeing, as European interest rates have moved up and your real rate of return on euros now is a positive, it makes sense to sit there and say, well, maybe we should hold some. At the end of the day, though, it's how nations and central banks and countries view that reserve currency they're holding. You can hold a reserve currency in anything you want. Dollars, gold, Swiss, grains, chicken, it doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. It's what you view as what's going to hold its value, what's going to have the depth and the infrastructure if I need to move this, what's going to have the liquidity, what's going to have the consistency over time. Dollar is going to be a big part of that going forward. Percentages might change a little bit, but at the end of the day, dollar is going to be around there for a long time.
Yeah, China loves to hold on to our dollars, right?
Sure.
I think their reserve is something like $3 billion. Dollars are at the top of that.
Yep.
Because of the cheap exports going over there.
Sure, exactly. Yeah. And remember how all this started. After World War II, the United States was the only game around. Allies won the war. The UK was pretty beaten up. All of our allies were pretty much bombed or pretty beaten up and financially, I won't say ruined, but they were on the brink. The United States was the only game around. The Axis forces, Germany, Japan, they were all defeated. So the U.S. became the World Bank. Everybody was comfortable holding dollars. And that inertia has propelled us from the 1940s all the way up into now. People are comfortable holding dollars. It's why the U.S. is one of the biggest, or is the biggest economy in the world. We've got the deepest capital markets that are out there and the deepest infrastructure. That's not going to change anytime soon. You might see it on the fringe, you know, let's hold 5 or 10% in euros or some other currency, but you're not going to see major swings. But if it happened, so what? That's okay. It's not going to hurt the United States at all. So you elect to hold euros versus U.S. It's going to flow through the FX markets, maybe. Depends on how long of a time you're going to change your mix around. Because these nations have capital flows that occur between central banks all the time. So you receive dollars, you receive euros, you elect not to exchange them, you're going to hold them in that currency. You've got your targets on what you want to hold. It's not going to matter to, it's not going to hurt our economy. It's not going to hurt our interest rates. Maybe it'll impact foreign exchange a little bit. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you're already talking a market that can move 15, 20, 25% in the course of a year. It's not going to move outside of that.
So then, if people are saying, gee, Don, I'm kind of nervous watching the market on a day-to-day basis, is your view still the long view? Still watch over time, or what kind of advice would you point people to in the short term?
Yeah, I'm still very bullish the United States. I'm still very, very bullish the United States. The U.S. has led everybody out of this, out of the recession and the doldrums that we were in. The world economies, especially the major ones, are starting to bubble forth, and they're coming forward as well. I'm surprised that we haven't had more or greater changes in U.S. interest rates. I'm surprised interest rates are relatively low. The yield curve is very, very flat. I think that's got the Fed sort of scratching their head a little bit. And they're trying to balance out, well, everything tells me there's inflationary pressures out there in the U.S., but we don't see them exactly yet. Maybe we see the beginnings of it, but it's certainly not represented in the yield curve. With that, you've got foreign countries that are sitting there really starting to bubble along with the U.S. Now, how do you keep that going? You know, and it gets back to me, to the whole tariff discussion that we had. Tariffs are bad initially, but what's the behind-the-channel communication going on? Why is the U.S. focusing on China, opening up Europe to sit there and do a lot of that trade? Mm-hmm. Because to me, the U.S. leads, that's the initial prime the engine, prime the pump of the world economy. Where it really starts is as Europe and other major countries step out, those flows come back to the United States as well as other parts of the world. And now you've got this two-way loop of the cycle that goes. And now the world economy, the world engine is really starting to bubble and really starting to cook. And that's, I think, very positive. That's sort of where I am. Still U.S., still going to be led by the U.S., still going to be driven by the U.S. Very, very bullish the U.S.
You mentioned Brexit earlier, and there was a survey done recently by some of the biggest banks. Their sentiment on Britain leaving the EU is more concerning than it was for the global financial crisis. And then we hear today that as many as 12% of companies may be looking to pull their business out of London at Brexit.
Sure. It's the prudent thing to do. If you're sitting there and you're a steward of a company that sits over in the UK, you have to sit there and say, as a steward, what am I doing with my shareholders and my owners? How am I protecting their interests? What are these unknowns that are on the horizon? Yeah, I think to some extent the downside, if you do nothing and something bad happens, if Brexit continues to bubble out and there's big significant economic impacts and you've done nothing, how are you going to explain that? So you may as well take a more of a defensive stance and say, well, what if? Let's expect, you know, hope for the best, expect the worst. Doesn't mean we're pulling up and running away, but we're going to sit there and have our avenues and our plans to move out, and maybe we start to move things mm-hmm. out of the UK a little bit. I think that's the prudent thing to do. I would be shocked if the markets over there and companies over there were not doing things like that.
Yeah. I thought of you recently. There's a video that's been going around, a viral video in the business world of a 10-year-old kid in Connecticut who is chattering on about Bitcoin, and he knows more about it than some of the experts they put up against him. Yeah. We've had conversations yeah. about Bitcoin before. What is it, like $5,000 this
yeah,
morning?
Yeah, I think it was $8,000. Yeah. But think about that, the flash in the pan that was.
Yeah.
I mean, we couldn't get enough of that. It was all over the and now it has just drifted off and has gone away. Still there, it'll still make headlines, but you know, not to the extent that it was. I mean, you know, once you turn the light on and you yeah. shine the light on these things, and the professional market really takes a deep dive look at what's going on there. Okay, it's either we're interested in it or we're not really interested in it. Flash in the pan, it's over. It was a pet rock. Yeah. I don't think you're going to hear much of Bitcoin other than negative news. You know, right. Gee, it sold off by 50% or something like that. You'll hear that, but. It's over.
I'm still jealous of this 10-year-old kid because he knows more about it than I do, though.
Isn't that the wave of the future, right, though, hey?
Don, it's always good seeing you. We'll see you again next month.
Thanks, Steve.
Don Lloyd is the SVP of Capital Markets, Foreign Exchanges and Derivatives at Associated Bank. He's our thought leader today. Make sure you listen every Thursday for our thought leader conversation here on The Opening Bell. And head over to associatedbank.com/thought leadership to learn more about Don and his colleagues, the other thought leaders, and listen to past thought leader conversations. And make sure you also follow Associated Bank on Twitter at Associated Biz.
Hi, this is Jim Dahlke with today's Inno Minute on WGN Radio, a rundown of all the Chicago innovation and tech news you need to know, delivered by ChicagoInno.com. During a Chicago visit this week, Apple announced it will begin offering free coding courses to teachers across Chicago to help them get more familiar with computer science. In the new program, Northwestern professors will lead coding sessions and will work with CPS teachers to ensure they understand coding concepts. Employment in Illinois' technology industry expanded by an estimated 4,000 jobs in 2017 and contributed $48 billion to the state's economy, according to a new report. The state has a total of 437,000 tech workers, which is fifth highest in the U.S. That's today's Inno Minute from WGN Radio. Learn more at ChicagoInno.com and sign up for The Beat, our daily email newsletter.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here with us on our Thursday edition of The Opening Bell. The Trump administration is starting to scale back federal efforts to enforce fair housing laws, freezing some enforcement sanctions against local governments and businesses, including Facebook, while sidelining officials who've been aggressively investigating civil rights cases. This move coincides with the decision this month by Ben Carson, who's the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, to strike the words inclusive and free from discrimination from HUD's mission statement. There's a lot of history about the Fair Housing Act. It's the 50th anniversary of it, and it involves Chicago, too. Chicago became the chosen battleground for fair housing. It was Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. who moved his family here in 1966 into one of the city's ghetto apartments to dramatize how people were forced to live. And one local company was at the center of changing things as well. Baird and Warner, the real estate company, and Lucy Baird is the company historian there, and she's with us this morning to talk a little bit about this. Lucy, good morning. Welcome to The Opening Bell.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Such a rich history with Chicago and the Fair Housing Act. And your family has had a front row seat to some of it. Tell us about the involvement of Baird and Warner.
Yeah, for sure. So for us, it actually started as early as 1962. That year, my grandfather testified before the Chicago Council for Human Relations, advocating for an open occupancy law. And he did that in his role as the president of the Metropolitan Housing and Planning Council. He went to present their stance in favor of open occupancy. But he found that the next morning he was on the cover of the Sun-Times and the story was on the front page of the Tribune. And he was really sort of listed as not only a part of the Metropolitan Housing and Planning Council, but the leader of one of the largest real estate companies in Chicago at the time. And that really sort of started his position as a really public advocate for open occupancy in Chicago.
What was the scene like back then that caused him to step up and testify and be part of this? What were residents, especially Black residents, forced to deal with?
You know, at that time there was a dual market, and so there were certain areas of the city that were only open to white citizens and certain areas of the city that were only open to citizens of color. And what this law on open occupancy was really hoping to do was make it available for anyone to live anywhere they could afford in the city. So it was really hoping to integrate the whole city.
There was a lot happening before this Fair Housing Act was signed on a federal level. You mentioned the testimony as early as 1962, but your grandfather and your family entered into an agreement to be fair on their own, right?
They did, and that was in 1995. And even before that, and throughout the entire 60s, my grandfather was fighting for it. He was writing letters to senators. He resigned from the Chicago Real Estate Board when they decided to sue the city after the city passed an open occupancy ordinance. And he testified before the Illinois House to help the open occupancy get passed on the state level. And then in the 90s, my father, Steve Baird, signed an agreement with a fair housing group to bring them in-house, which was really unusual at the time. And even today, just this year, we made it mandatory for our offices to host 4 modules on fair housing. And that's something that we do because we know it's the right thing to do, not because it's required of us.
And give us a sense of here 50 years later, how things are different or perhaps even the same in Chicago.
You know, it's I think just all the news that's come out recently, it just proves how important this bill is and how important it is that we celebrate this anniversary and really remember the significance of it being passed.
Also, not only that, now, as I mentioned in the opening of our segment here, really fighting to have it scaled back. It's bewildering to me that there would even be talk about scaling it back, but here we are.
Yeah, it's bewildering, too, especially, you know, having looked through our files, and we have a huge file in fair housing. My grandfather received hundreds of letters at the time of people against it and for it. And, you know, to him, this cause was so important, he diligently responded to each of these letters saying, this is why I believe what I believe. This is why this is so important for us as a city, as a state, and as a country to really commit to this. And so to think about all of that work and all of that sort of stance being lost now is just really heartbreaking.
I was reading recently some other real estate types in one of the journals that the fair housing part of this, the discrimination has moved from the actual selling and buying of the real estate to the lending market. And that's where we're seeing a lot of discrimination these days. Would you agree with that assessment? And how is Baird & Mortar involved in that these days?
You know, I know we have a mortgage company. I don't know as much about that, to be honest with you. So I would have to check on that and get back to you.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the expense and the cost, not necessarily dollar-wise, but it must have been difficult for a company to take the stance that yours did back in the 1960s.
Yeah, you know, and I think we even have letters and archives from other realtors to my grandfather saying, you know, I admire your stance, but I can't say anything because I'm worried that it will be the end of my company. And the interesting thing is that I found in our files is people really thought of it as a risk to take a stance, but we also have letters from companies and from people saying, we'll only do business with you now because you made this stance, committing to us as a company because we advocated for open occupancy. So, you know, it's one of those things where I think that's a misconception. Taking a stand is not something that shouldn't be done because of the bottom line. And I just think, too, it's such an incredible legacy to leave. It's something that he did in the early 60s, and he really sort of set the tone for our company to continue to ask ourselves, how can we be recommitting to fair housing? How can we be really thinking about his commitment and honoring this commitment as much as we can? So in that sense, that legacy is really so important.
You must have an amazing job there, the going through of the letters and looking at all of this history and some of these documents. I'm wondering, were there any surprises as you went through some of that stuff that stick out to you?
You know, I think the thing that's so amazing is that we have it all. You know, it's incredible that we are 163 years old. Yesterday was actually our birthday, so we're happily celebrating that. But the thing that I love about our archives is that the earliest members of the company really knew we were going to survive, or at least I think so, and that's why all these things were kept, because there was kind of this feeling of what we're doing is important and we want to save it for the next generations of the company. And so we have documents dating back to our founding, which is such a unique thing to have. And, you know, our company really grew up with the city. We ran an ad in the 70s that said we grew up together. And I think that's so true. So many of the things in our archives pertain to not only our history, but early Chicago history and, you know, stories of how the city changed and how we changed with it over the years. In terms of surprises, I've uncovered a few stories that even my dad didn't know. And I think, too, just sort of uncovering the depth. I mean, the fair housing file is an incredible example. We have so many letters in there. And the fact that my grandfather saved all of these and responded to all of these was something that I didn't know. And it's such an incredible record now to have, you know, all these voices on this really controversial topic at the time.
I'm curious, because he was here and doing a lot of work, and as I mentioned, even living here for a time, if your family had direct contact with Martin Luther King Jr.?
You know, I don't know if we did. I haven't heard that we did. We were definitely working, you know, for the same end goal. But I don't know. I wish I knew.
Very interesting. Lucy, we appreciate you sharing some of this with us. And congratulations to you and your family on being around for so long. It's wonderful.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
Lucy Baird is the company historian at Baird and Warner on the 50th anniversary of the Fair Housing Act.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, Dow futures are pointing toward a strong open on Wall Street later this morning, up 84 points this morning. NASDAQ futures are up 44. S&P futures are up about 11. Now the latest on agriculture and commodities. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning. This is the last trading day of the week at the Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange and on Wall Street. And so today we get some important numbers from the USDA. But looking back at yesterday, livestock futures mostly higher at the Mercantile Exchange. Both cattle and hogs recovering from recent lows on bargain buying and positioning ahead of the reports due out later today. Most of the lean hog contracts jumped 3% or more on the Mercantile Exchange. That came after notching lifetime lows earlier. Most active June hogs up $2.60 to end the day at $76.62. And the cattle market yesterday, April live cattle ended the day 57 cents higher at $116, and March feeder cattle up 55 cents at $135.97. Grain market yesterday, we saw some new lows set there. The wheat market hit a two-month low. Corn and soybeans choppy ahead of the USDA reports today. But as I look at my grain screen, it was totally red. Corn, soybeans, and wheat ending the day lower. Now, back to the reports today. Well, at 11 o'clock this morning, Chicago time, we will get the quarterly grain stocks report, and we'll get the planning intentions report. And then at 2 o'clock this afternoon, Chicago time, we will get the quarterly pig crop report. Have a good day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. You as well. One other story before we leave you here this morning involving Chicago-based CME Group. CME Group has reached a deal to acquire NEXT for $5.5 billion. NEXT Group, it's an offer valued again at $5.5 billion. Transaction expected to close in the second half of 2018, pending the approval of regulators and NEXT shareholders. The acquisition will be a share price of $158.84, according to CNBC. NEXT is a provider of currency and fixed income platforms and other over-the-counter post-trade products and services. Now the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook for Thursday, March the 29th. Commerce Department issues February income, personal income, and consumer spending today. Consumer spending accounts for roughly 70% of the U.S. Economy. So this a big report today, a nice gauge of how the economy is doing. Also today, Freddie Mac will report on average U.S. mortgage rates. Also today, jobless claims and Chicago PMI. Bloomberg's Consumer Comfort Index is due out as well, along with the EIA Natural Gas Report. Constellation Brand earnings today. And tomorrow, the markets will be closed for Good Friday, a three-day weekend for the markets.